Okay, so hi everyone. Welcome back to CYC's Fellow Led Podcast Personal Statement. This is episode 6. I can't believe we've already been through 6 episodes. If you haven't seen the other ones, I mean, definitely go check them out. But on this podcast, this is where we just sit down, virtually, of course, with influential community leaders and members to showcase how they make a statement in our community and beyond. So today I will be your co-host, Miliani Smith. I am a junior at Charlotte Country School, and my pronouns, she, hers, hers.
And I'm your co-host, Hannah, a junior at Independence High School, and I'm involved in the theater community at my school. Now, we are really making history this year. Our election turnout was crazy. We had the most votes ever this year, and not to mention the results of this election.
I don't even know how to process it. Like, there's so much going on. Last week was definitely crazy. And like you said, like, we're definitely making history. Like, not only do we have, like, the most votes that were, like, ever cast, and, like, there were so many different activists going out to get people registered to vote, but now we have the first vice president-elect woman, and also a woman of color, South Asian, and African-American. So I just think that's absolutely amazing. And living through history, I think that's what this whole, like, summer and past few months have been about, which is, like, making changes and making history as we go. So
speaking of people in our communities making changes, we have joining us today Andrea Smith. She is the Chief Operation Officer at Bank of America. She is a thought leader on economic mobility and supporting the advancement of women in our headquarters city of Charlotte and nationally. Smith serves on the boards of numerous nonprofit organizations, including the PGA of America and the Charlotte Sports Foundation. She also co-chairs the Leading on Opportunity Council, which is working to address economic mobility in Charlotte.
Thanks for the introduction, Hannah and Millie. I'm thrilled to be here today, and I can't wait to hear what's on everybody's minds. As I said earlier, I'm open for any question and want this to really be a conversation.
Well, that is great. We love to hear that. And just one last message to our listeners. Thank you for tuning in once again. And it's time to buckle up and let's get personal.
So, Andrea, you have many accolades under your belt, and I just want to name a few. Most influential business leaders in North Carolina, 2019. Most powerful women in banking, 2019. Charlotte Business Woman of the Year, 2017. How does it feel to be recognized as a leader in your industry?
Well, I think it's great for the company, and I think it's great for all the teams that I lead, for the leader to be recognized. It feels good, but you know what? I'm really sort of the tip of the arrow. So I have a great team behind me, and I love that it brings recognition to the Bank of America. We do good work all around the world. And so when you get this recognition, you really talk about the platforms that we're using to drive good change and outcomes for the better. So it's a nice start, but my goal is to get more people recognized. And so when you get recognized, bringing others along with you and getting them highlighted and getting them exposure is part of what we do.
So how do you balance being a high-powered executive with also being a mom, wife, daughter, and friend?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. And it's, you know, what you have to figure out over time that there's no silver bullet for that. It's personal. It's different for every single person. And so for me, I've turned down a lot of jobs in my career that would take me away from my family every single night. I've been offered jobs that require travel that I know would be taking clients out to dinner every night. And that just wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to be able to be very successful. I wanted to be able to change lives, but also live my own life. And so, you know, it's about trade-offs, and it's about figuring out, each person has to figure out what's important to them, and then draw, you know, kind of build your guardrails and make sure that you're fitting in work with your life versus work being your life. And that's a lot easier said than done. I mean, I'm way older than all of you, and it takes practice, and sometimes it doesn't work out exactly like that, but you also, you know, you've got people around you. You know, I'm really a big believer in it takes a village. It takes a village with my kids. It takes a village with the family. I like to be part of other people's villages. And, you know, it's that's sort of how it works for us. But I've been very lucky. My husband, when we got married when I was 30, and my career was starting to take off. And so We had our first child when I was 33, then 35, and then 37. And we were both working. And at one point, we handed the children off to each other in the airport. And we sort of said, you know, this is not exactly how we thought this would go. So we had a talk. And I said, you know what? I love my job. And I really feel like I'm having an impact. And he said, you know what? I don't really love mine. So why don't we just bank on yours for now? And I'll stay home and take care of the children. And, you know, that was a bold move, really. And you didn't have a lot of men doing that. And so, you know, but it's worked out for us. But it's not something I ever take for granted. We talk about it. You know, well, not anymore, because he's happy with what he's doing and he's figured out some other things. And I love what I'm doing. But for a while there, every year we would say, are you still loving what you're doing? Want to keep doing it that way? Are you comfortable here? So it's really quite a partnership, I would say. And I feel blessed because I grew up, my mom was divorced. She had me when she was 20. She dropped out of college to have me. She raised three kids really on her own and then put herself back through school. And, you know, we talk all the time and she's always saying, gosh, you know, you do all these things. I'm like, yeah, but look what you did without anybody helping you, you know? And so I feel really blessed to be able to put all the pieces together this way.
I have to say, I love your dedication to your family and your community. So we know staying mentally and physically fit is a huge part of maintaining work-life balance. How do you practice self-care with such a demanding schedule?
Well, you know, I used to be really good at that before quarantine and COVID came along. I used to have really good sort of balance, leave work, come home, cook dinner, do homework, hang out with the family. And then when we got into the quarantine, I had a lot of anxiety. I mean, I had three kids doing school at home, my husband around, the animals, like I was working all the time. People would call me at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. I'd be in bed. I answered the phone thinking maybe something really bad had happened, like a tragic accident, and it would be an update about a meeting. I'm like, okay, this has got to stop, you know, and this is not healthy. So I've been really deliberate and intentional while we're in COVID. So I pick an end time every day. So I'm going to end my work day at 6 o'clock. And that I'm going to go out of my office and I'm going to have dinner and I'm going to do whatever I do. And that doesn't mean I'm not going to check emails or be available if there is an emergency, but I'm not going to take calls and do emails all night long and not have a stopping point. So that's been something that has really helped make a difference. The other thing that I've done that I wasn't as deliberate doing before is I commit to an hour of exercise a day. Now, this is not exactly one continuous hour because it's rare that you get that, but it might be 3 10-minute slots where I go out and I walk around the block or I take the dog on a quick walk and then a 30-minute exercise at the end of the day or before the day starts. But that is, I have to have that to clear my head. And so that's my commitment to me, because what I noticed the first thing in COVID to go was time for me to get a new perspective, to clear my head so that I can figure out, okay, what do I need to prioritize? What do I need to get done now? And so those two things I've really, you know, been deliberate about in quarantine, and it's really reduced my anxiety and it's helped me really feel more in control, because, you know, things can feel so overwhelming is what I've experienced.
Yeah, I know. I have also felt like a ton of anxiety throughout quarantine. It was funny because, like, I was actually talking about that in class today about how quarantine has affected us. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, I think it's real. And you know, and that's the thing we need to acknowledge. I talk all the time about it's okay not to be okay. And let's just have a conversation about it. And then if we know that, we can help get resources, or even having a conversation helps bring it down a little bit and make everyone see that everyone's going through this, maybe in different degrees. Maybe some people don't have kids. Maybe they got, you know, older parents or other people living with them or people with underlying health conditions or whatever it may be. Everyone's got something. And so just opening the door to talk about it, I think, makes a huge difference.
I agree completely. And I love that you're so open to these things. All right. So we also understand that you're a pretty big golfer. We wanted to theme today's interview based on something you might experience on the course. Let's start at the driving range and get you warmed up. Make sure your swing is good to go.
And we know that, like, with wearing, like, so many hats and having so many, like, accolades and, like, your job and everything, it's no question that, like, each day is going to bring, like, unique set of, like, opportunities and challenges. So we were just curious, like, what does your average day look like? Or do you even, like, have an average day?
Yeah, it's a great question. I really don't have an average day. So anything can happen on any given day. I could, like, today... a senator of a state called me. That wasn't even on my calendar. A CEO of a company in another place called me to get some advice on something. That wasn't on my calendar. You know, the I had a call about someone that wanted me to buy a building in a different city. I mean, so I have planned things every day, but my portfolio is so diverse, which is why I love my job, that there's it's not the same every day. So that's why I'm constantly challenged. I'm not bored. And there's just, it's all very different. So, you know, I've got marketing, I've got communications, I've got media and investor relations. So all the press releases, all the branding, I've got real estate. So every building that you see that has Bank of America on it is in my portfolio. We have 76 million square feet around the world. 7,000 buildings that I'm responsible for. I've got vendor management. So every vendor that we use in the entire company goes through my team. I've got something called capital planning. So when you, you guys have studied this, but you know, when you buy a stock and you get a dividend or shares are bought back, my team does all the capital planning for the company. So that's something totally different. I have all the market presidents around the country. We have 91 of them. So I'm responsible for all those 91 markets and what happens and how we take our company really global and make it local. And we really think that's our secret sauce because we have 210,000 employees in 40 countries around the world. But does that really matter to you, Millie? No. What you want to know is what's happening in your local community, right? And who's your bank? And we want to know you. And we want to show that we can listen to you. We can understand what you need. And then we can provide you the products and services that are going to help you achieve what you need. So, you know, it's so different that every day you get some of a little bit of that. And then finally, I'm in charge of business continuity. So when COVID hit, you know, our team was planning how to do, originally we thought we would do AB teams, you know, team A would come in 1 week, team B would come in 1 week. So we'd work through all that. But then when we saw the virus sort of taking off, we said, no, that's never going to work. We're just going to have to put everyone out. So we put 180,000 people working from home right now, 30,000 in the office, made sure that all the people had equipment, they had a way to log in. We set up drive-throughs. We turned some of our buildings into drive-throughs and shipped thousands of Chromebooks that were already loaded with the technology that people needed, had them drive through, give their ID, pick up their Chromebook so they could go home and work. So, you know, we've just learned to be very creative through this whole process. And that's not something we've ever planned. I mean, I think our business continuity planning is probably better than none, but no one had planned for a health pandemic. So we didn't know that we were going to need face masks or hand sanitizer or gloves for our tellers in the financial centers touching cash. So we had to procure all of that right away. So luckily, we were able to use our buying power and our scale. And many of our clients that were breweries changed into creating hand sanitizer. So instead of making beer, they were making hand sanitizer, but they needed bottles so that we could get the bottles to put the hand sanitizer in. So we did a lot of public-private partnerships that way. But so far to date, we've all of our people coming to work, which are 30,000, have masks. We were one of the first people to ask customers coming into the financial center to wear masks. And then we've donated 15 million masks around the United States to over 700 nonprofits that serve low to moderate income communities, because we can buy it and we can get it and we know many can't afford it.
Okay.
But that's why it's not ever a normal day. You can see, I mean, it's just, there's, you know, if we're going to run a new commercial, if we're going to do something, you know, some big announcement or a sponsorship or something, it's all very different.
Okay, well, I mean, I am, I just had to like take that all in because that was so much. I mean, like, we ask this question like all the time on the podcast, and like, obviously, all these successful people have like such like busy days. I think that you might have the busiest day so far and like the most unexpected things happening. But wow, I'm impressed. I know that you mentioned earlier that you want to be able to recognize the people that you work with and push them into the light. And I was just wondering, like, as a leader of those teams, like, how do you continue to build community while working from home?
Well, that is a great question. And, you know, it's something that I hadn't spent a lot of time thinking about until we got home. And so one of the things I did, because you can feel so isolated, even, you know, when you're talking to people all day long. So one of the things we started doing is this is my personal iPad. We can't really do Zoom at work, but WebEx. So we could see people, because I do think it makes a big difference if you can just make eye contact with somebody. The other thing that I did that has made a huge difference is schedule regular 2-deep conversations with each of my direct reports, regular one-on-ones with each of them, regular all hands. There's about, you know, 6,000 people on the team. So trying to get to all of them in big groups and small groups, because what I also realized, it's sometimes intimidating to ask a question in 4,000 or 5,000 people, but it's a lot easier if it's 100 or 50 or 30. So really been deliberate about creating connections like that. And I'll tell you, we do an employee survey every year. And this year, our team got the highest marks it's ever gotten. And the one common theme that people said, I have never felt more connected to the company in my life. I've been here 25 years, 30 years, 15 years. But because of the deliberate communication versus just assuming it's going to happen, which I think is what I did before, I would have normal routines. But when you're in the office, you just naturally assume you're going to see people, connect with people. And so this will be one thing I do take away after COVID, when we get back to whatever the new normal is, to be very deliberate about how I connect, how I touch base, how I interact with people, because it has made a big difference. And I want to continue to do that. And I talked to my leadership team about doing the very same. And that's how I think you create community. My team will interview me on things just like this with their whole team. So we try to do fun things, and they'll ask me, you know, my favorite song, what I want to do, or, you know, just random questions. So you kind of just, you're being authentic, but you're letting people get to know you more than it seems like we used to do in the more formal corporate setting, if that makes sense. I mean, my dog came in a minute ago. I have a great day. The dog may poke her head up, or the cat may come. I mean, and it happens at work too. I mean, it's just, I've let everyone know. You're going to get real at the Smith house. There's no telling who might pop up on the screen.
I love hearing your dedication to communication in your community. Like I said earlier, at work, and hearing about the efforts you're putting forth to continue that, not only in this quarantine setting, but in the setting of when you return. So you kind of gave us a breakdown of your responsibilities and what your day-to-day could look like. Do you have like a favorite responsibility?
Well, you know, one of my favorite things that I feel privileged to get to do in my job is the impact I can have in the community and in lots of communities. That's, you know, when I went to SMU, and Marcos is here, and I know you guys are going to talk to SMU afterwards, but I thought I was going to be a doctor. So my grandfather on my mom's side was a doctor, and he was like the doctor in the old days. And you all probably don't even remember this because you're too young, but he would get paid in chickens and vegetables and a gallon of milk, or, you know, eggs, whatever it may be. And we made house calls, and I'd go with him on all the house calls, and it was so fun. So I always thought I wanted to be a doctor because I saw how much he helped people, and I saw him changing lives, delivering babies, whatever it may be. So I went to SMU pre-med, and, you know, I also, because I went to SMU on a couple of different scholarships, I also had to work while I was there. So I worked at this little tiny bank called the Oaks Bank and Trust. And when I say tiny, I mean, there are 20 employees at this bank. So I got to do every job. I was a teller, I was a proof operator, a customer service rep, anything this little bank needed me to do, I did it. So in my sophomore year, I realized, you know, I love working and I wasn't doing so well in pre-med. I mean, it was a lot of studying and I thought, this is going to take 10 more years. I love working. I see my customers at the grocery store, at the cleaners. They're like, hey, Andrea. I'm like, oh, yes. So I said to my advisor, I've got to change majors. I need to graduate still in 4 years, but I can't do this. So he said, well, why don't you become an econ degree? And get an econ degree. I'm like, okay. So that's what I graduated with. So I'm looping all the way around to say, you know, I didn't set out to be this, right? But I ended up with an econ major. And my point to this story is that I think, you know, the part of my job I love is impacting the community. I have a great platform at Bank of America to be able to do that. It was a circuitous way to get there, but I do feel like we change lives every single day by what we do at the bank, whether it's helping people get their first mortgage to get a house, whether it's helping them get a student loan, whether it's the work we do in the community with our nonprofit partners, whether it's the partnerships we have with our HBCUs, our community colleges or other. But I do feel like that's what I'm doing. I'm just not doing it as a doctor.
I was like noticing, like, as you were talking, once again, it's like crazy how like successful people like all do the same things. Like, I don't know, like we all need to like hop on like this bandwagon. I don't, just saying. So once again, if you're listening, go check out the other ones and then you can like learn how to be successful. So like one thing that like we like to showcase on here is the path that each of our guests have taken to their current role. And it seems like you've had a similar path to some of our other guests in the instance that like it wasn't direct, like you thought you wanted to become a doctor and everything. So I just wanted to know, like, what was your biggest lesson that you learned from college or like while in college?
Well, I think, you know, my lesson, I've learned a lot of lessons. But I think if you start that, it's not a straight path. Like, I didn't know, well, first of all, the job I'm in today didn't even exist at the company 6 years ago. Okay. So let's just back up. So you heard about my college sort of career from pre-med to econ, but then what I didn't get to is, so when I graduated, I had an offer from the small bank that I told you that I worked at, the Oaks Bank. And then I had an offer from the big bank, First Republic downtown. And it was really big, big Texas bank. And they were going to pay me $2,000 more a year than the small bank. So I took that job. So on my very first day, I show up for work, so excited, get there, go in, meet with my boss. And she says, oh, I'm so sorry, your job has been eliminated. And I'm like, what are you talking about? No one even called me. Here I am. She said, yeah, that we're getting rid of that whole department, but we have another job for you. We want you to be a computer programmer. And I said, do you have to have any computer classes? I mean, what, you know, I had one computer class in college. And she said, no, I mean, you can learn it. I think it'll be fine. And I said, oh, okay. So I went home that night. So I thought, okay, well, I can quit and no one will ever know because my job's already been eliminated. I can go work at the small bank because they already made me an offer, or I can take a chance and see what it's like to be a computer programmer, which is something I never thought I would do. So I decided to do that. So for lesson one, resilience, take a chance on yourself, right? So did it, hated it, but I learned a lot and I learned that I didn't like it, but I kept doing it and I kept doing it really well. And guess what? That bank failed 6 weeks after I started. Now, you can probably see why they failed, because they put people that didn't have any experience in jobs. Like, they put me as a computer programmer without any computer experience. Who knows how much they were doing that? I'm teasing. There were a lot of issues, but I kept going. The new company that came in was NCMB. From North Carolina. They bought First Republic. They came in and they started interviewing people that, you know, my age, I'd been there for by then about a year, and said, you know, we'd like to put you in this this management development program and technology and operations. Would you like to do that? I said, sure. Again, I didn't know what it was, but I knew I didn't like being a programmer and this was not being a programmer. So I did that. I learned a lot. I got to work on mergers and acquisitions. Then I got sent to all these different cities. Every time we bought a company, I would go and do something different. I would install a mortgage lending system. I would install a teller system. I would do all the training. I would hire the staff, the bubble staff, to support the customers while I was training people. But the point is, I kept trying more and more things to figure out what I really loved. I mean, I thought those things were interesting along the way. But then I got to be a recruiter, and I loved being a recruiter, and I'd never been a recruiter. So you can also see there's a track record of doing lots of things that I had never done before. But if you're curious, if you're willing to learn, if you're willing to put in the time, you can do different jobs. There's a lot of skill sets that are really portable, whether it's relationship management, whether it's collaboration, whether it's leadership, all those things you can take with you. And then you can learn the subject matter of a different role. So that's what I did. So all of these things taught me lessons, though. I also learned to say no. If a job, as I started out at the beginning, didn't fit what I needed to be doing. Like, I got a big offer for a huge job when I was planning my wedding. And I said, no, I can't do it. And they were all, you know, all the administrators was like, what? Why can't you do it? So I'm getting married, and I want to be able to plan my wedding. I want to enjoy my wedding. And so they said, fine. But if you do that, which is great, you can always say no. You have to take control of putting your name back in the mix. Don't wait for other people to do it. When you're ready, you need to put the word out. I'm ready now for that next big job. Probably won't be the one that you turn down, but you need to put your name back. Don't wait for someone else to do that for you. So I learned that. I also learned how to cope with bad bosses. I'll never forget, I was in ATM operations, another job I hated. But again, I feel like it's just as important to figure out what you don't like as what you do like. And so did ATM operations. The boss was terrible, totally terrible, made men and women cry, grown men, grown women. And so I went and talked to the HR person, and I said, you know, this guy is horrible. I mean, everyone's crying all the time. And I was like 26. And she said, well, you're a whiner. He may be making everyone cry, but you're a whiner. And I said, excuse me? She said, you can't just come in here with a problem. You need to go solve it. I said, how am I possibly going to solve a 55-year-old man making everyone cry? And I'll never forget this. And I tell this all the time. You control what you can control. So go back, figure out what you can control, and do that. So I did. So I gathered everyone up in the office, and I said, you know what? We're going to control what we can control. We're going to have potluck lunches. We're going to walk outside on a break. We're going to create something here that makes us happy. And you know what? It was great. And ultimately, he got fired. But the point is, you know, you learn all these lessons on the way. And you then share them back with people like we're doing today, because, you know, as much as you can help people not step into some of the same potholes you stepped into, the better off they're going to be. So I tell people all the time, I love to hear things that are not working, but bring me your ideas of how to fix it. Don't just bring me problems, because I can't, don't think that I know how to fix everything. I'd love to hear your ideas of how we can fix it and make it better.
Thank you for all of those like life lessons and advice. One thing that really stuck out was the last thing that you said about like bad bosses. And I kind of like relate that to having like a bad teacher. Like, you might not love the class or like love the teacher, but you can like always learn something from that and take it like on to the future. So I think your life lessons apply to everywhere, not just the job or being like the executive person. So
that's exactly right, Millie. And it's sort of, you know, it's also what I always took from people everywhere along the way, people that I don't want to be like and people that I do want to be like. So what are skills that you want to take from someone? Well, who do you want to emulate? And what do you want to make sure that you're never like, right? And so I think that's really important, how you develop your leadership style. And, you know, it's one thing that's really like critical to me that I just want to highlight here is find your passion. You know, this whole journey that I've been on about figuring out what I like, figuring out what I don't like, is all around finding my passion and how I can put it all together in my job. And that's why impacting the community is so important to me, because that's where my passion is. The fact that I get to do it from a platform of Bank of America makes it even more powerful, you know? And so that's something But you'll never find your passion if you don't try different things. I tell my kids this all the time too. You'll never figure out what you love if you don't do some things that you may hate. I mean, that's just sort of it. But that's why that journey is so important.
Obviously, like, this is your passion, but I just wanted to ask if you could like switch your career, what else would you do besides obviously your wonderful job right now?
Oh man, you know what? I would love to be a rock star. I mean, it is like, I don't even know if you guys know the Foo Fighters, but Dave Grohl is like, he's way too old for you, but he is so cool. Or, I mean, give me any, I love Alicia Keys. I'd love to go pound out the piano and belt out a song. I took my kids to see Jay-Z. I mean, that dude is talented. I mean, like, just, I'd love to be a rock star. But first of all, I have a terrible voice, but the kids hear me singing all the time. I turn up the music really loud, but I do love live music and I really miss it.
just another question that I have, you've been talking about like all your successes and then also like your different like paths that you've taken. This is a little bit like of an outlier question, but like what's something that you have failed at in the past that has really impacted your professional or personal life?
Well, let's go back into my career. So when I was a computer programmer, doing all these, writing all these if then else programs in COBOL, C, Fortran, you know, I thought I had discovered a major fraud in the company because my reports were showing that 90% of these accounts, all accounts, didn't have signature cards, this, that, and the other. So I gathered up all my reports and I went to tell my boss, like, look what I have found. And again, these lessons you never really forget. He said, did you talk to any of your team about this? I'm like, no, why? I mean, I found the problem. I'm bringing it to you. I mean, we've got a serious compliance issue. He said, well, if you would have talked to them, you would realize that you left out a few lines of code and we actually don't have a problem. But, you know, back to connecting with your team and the power of the group is much more than the power of one, right? And so sharing information creates more power versus going on your own. So that was a big lesson. So I've always then used that going forward. Let's collaborate. Let me pull the string all the way through. Let me touch base with other people. How does this all fit together? And then the second thing that was really important to me was when I was in HR, I was on my way up and it was before I was running HR, but I was very senior and but very young. And I got invited to this meeting and everyone was much, much older than me. And we start talking about something and I knew I had the right answer. I mean, it was so clear that I knew what to do. And so, you know, everyone talked and no one called on me. And I just said at the end, well, here's what I think. And I laid out my whole plan. And I mean, I knew it was right. And they just kind of went right around me and didn't respond. And so the guy that was running HR at the time came to my office afterwards. And he said, Andrea, that was absolutely the best idea. But do you know why no one came along with you? I said, you know, I have no idea. What's wrong with these people? And he said, because the way that you did that, you didn't respect anyone else's idea along the way. You didn't say, hey, Millie, that's a really good idea. But if we add XYZ to it, maybe we could do, you know, ABC, or hey, Hannah, if we put yours and Millie's idea together plus this, maybe we could collectively move forward. And he said, it's not about everyone adopting your idea and coming out of the room with your idea being successful. It's about getting the best idea. And he said, so what you need to learn is how you navigate that, do it respectfully, put your idea on the table and come out with something that's collectively better. So those two things always, you know, I keep in the front of my mind, you know, and I also give people feedback when I see them doing things like that too. And that's a great idea, but it's not about your idea. It's about the best idea. And it's about what's best for our customers and clients and our teammates and our communities and how we fit all that together. And so those two things, I think, you know, I learned a lot from.
We also practice those things here at like CYC with our seminar, always having like group conversations and like respecting what other people have to say and the ideas that they have. So I'm glad to hear that. Love that CYC is on top of everything per the usual. Yeah. So I have two like follow-up questions. So other than your degree, is like, is there any particular skill that really helped you along your journey? And then also, what resources should fellows or any other students listening take advantage of to gain those skills?
Well, I'd say two things that just pop to mind are being curious. Never stop learning. Don't, you know, whether it's reading or meeting with people or, you know, going to have lunch with people that are in a different field than you and understanding how, you know, what they do and what impact it has. Because part of what I've done along my whole career is never let my job define me, but I define my job. And here's what I mean by that. Some people put themselves in a box. This is my job. This is what I'm going to do. I've chosen to approach my entire career around understanding how my box fits into all the other boxes. So what is it that I'm doing and how does that connect along the value chain of what everyone else is doing? And so that I understand the end-to-end picture. So I think being curious always, asking a lot of questions. I believe asking a lot of questions is really good. And sometimes you may think it's not a great question, but sometimes it's a question that no one's ever asked and it can be turning the light bulb off for everybody, you know, like, why actually are we doing this? And no one ever stopped to say, well, why are we doing this? Does anyone actually use this report anymore? Is anyone actually, who is using this? Can we stop doing this? If we stop doing this, would anyone care? Those are good questions. And then the second thing, Millie, that I think would define me through my career would be courage. And maybe even through my whole life. I was having a lunch with Hugh McCall years ago. He's a fabulous mentor of mine. I meet with him. I just met with him yesterday. I'm meeting with him again next week. But, you know, he asked me, he said, assuming everyone is the same smartness, and how do you think you've done what you've done compared to other people that were equally or maybe smarter than you, which I'm sure there are plenty of. And I said, I think it's courage. I think I've taken some risk on myself. I think I put myself in situations where I didn't have all the facts, but I was curious. I built relationships. I asked people for help. You go in with your eyes wide open. What could happen? Well, you could fail. Okay. Well, I'm going to fail. I'm going to pick myself back up and learn what I needed to learn and learn something more from that failure and go back in and try something else. And so I think it's about not being afraid to fail. It's about learning when you fail. I mean, I think some of the best learnings are when you fail versus when you succeed and how you apply that. So I think it's, you know, courage and curiosity would be the couple of things that I'd say. The third thing I would say is just be authentic. You gotta be true to yourself. This one boss I had early on, it just set up all these rules. Like you couldn't leave before she left and she would put her glasses on the desk and her coat on her chair. So being one of the newest ones to the team, I would stay till 10. And then I'm like, what in the world? This woman, is she ever going to, but I never saw her. Finally, about 3 weeks into that role, my teammates took me aside and they're like, listen, you know what? She says this to everyone. She leaves early, like at 5, but she just doesn't want other people to leave. And then I saw her out at dinner and she like walked up to me and so happy and friendly. I'm like, oh my gosh, this woman is so disingenuous. So I promised myself right then and there, I will always be the same. Inside work, outside of work, what you see is what you get. I'm authentic. I think it's the only way to be, really. I mean, life is too short. You got to just be who you are, be able to look yourself in the mirror, know you left it all on the field. You did it with integrity. And just, you know, that's to me, that's what this, life is too short. That's how you want to be.
Thank you for that wonderful advice and just really in-depth answer to my question. I think what I got from that was also like networking. I mean, like you mentioned, like asking other people questions and going to lunch with people, and then like also having a mentor or just people that you can look up to and that you feel comfortable talking to. So I think that's really important as well. And I think that was like within your message. So thank you for that.
Millie, it is having a mentor, I think, or someone that will give you feedback. So that's another thing I've learned. So I've had like a lot of mentors along the way, but some always are like, oh, you know, you're so great or this or that. And I'm like, no, I want to know what I can do better. Where am I not having as big of an impact as I could, and help me figure that out and tell me and be on, you know? And so having someone that's going to be candid, but you got to want to get that feedback too. And you got to ask for feedback. And I mean, I remember early in my career, I'm like, feedback? What? Why do I need feedback? You know, but then as you go, you're like, okay, this is super helpful, because then you see what others maybe seeing or perceiving that wasn't your intent. And so I just think it's really important to ask for that and then act on it.
All right. So how did CYC become, quote unquote, playing partners with Andrea Smith?
Well, I think you have the lovely Miss Kasam, who I see Miss Catherine on this call today, to thank for that. So I'll never forget. I think, Catherine, it was soon after you all moved here that we met at Starbucks and went through what you all had built in Baton Rouge. And you told me about Aaron, and we start talking about Brick at the Baton Rouge and what you want to do in Carolinas. And so that was my very first introduction. And then as Sean and I have gotten more involved in understanding of what CYC does, I mean, we just think the work that you all do is amazing. The you all coming out of CYC are amazing. And so, you know, when we had the opportunity to sit down and talk to Aaron and Catherine around a way that we could have an impact, we came up with this idea. Even though the fellows get so many scholarships, often there's still a gap in funding. And so that's why we created our scholarship to help, you know, reduce that gap. I think education is a foundation for so many things. Being able to go to college and be able to do it with as little debt as possible, I think is what we want to help achieve here. And so from all the fellows that I've met, I know everyone is very hardworking. I know no one takes anything for granted. I know CYC has spent so much time with you all, and we're just thrilled to be part of it. And I was on a call today with some people, and we're just trying to get more of the word out and talk about what a fabulous organization this is and what fabulous students that they help unlock and produce.
So the Leading on Opportunity List report names three determinants that are believed to have the greatest influence on the opportunity trajectory of an individual. Today, we want to focus on the college career and readiness of the report. How does your relationship with CYC fit into this?
Well, I think it fits squarely into the middle of it, because part of what we figured out in the Leading on Opportunity Task Force report, which was a direct result of the Chetty study, which showed that Charlotte was the least likely out of 50 cities for kids to get out of poverty that were born in poverty. So that's sort of the genesis of all that. So CYC fits smack dab in the middle of college and career readiness, because what we learned is that kids weren't making it, not only not making it to college, weren't even making it out of high school. So we have 40,000 opportunity youth in Charlotte from age 18 to 23 that have either dropped out of high school, maybe have a high school degree, maybe a little bit of college, maybe not. And so how do we help tackle that and help create paths of skills to jobs? And so part of that is working with CMS and doing career technical education. Part of it is things like CYC. So it's taking all these levers and putting them together, because we also know that not everyone is going to go to college. Not everyone needs to go to college. Not everyone can afford to go to college. So how we create different paths for folks, how we create maybe junior college paths, and then how we create four-year paths. So all of that is right there and leading on opportunity. And I think CYC, it's just like a hand in glove situation. So that's another reason we're so passionate about it.
Once again, so thank you for like the whole scholarship. We love that. That was a surprise at the Torch Awards. Everything that people do. I mean, Miss Kasam is giving you like credits in the chat, but like also want to give her credits as well. And like also all of the other donors as well. Everyone who supports CYC is absolutely amazing.
Miss Catherine is amazing. I will go with you on that, Millie.
Yes. Talking about like supporting each other, you had made a post about Justice Ginsburg, and I just wanted to read the excerpt that you had posted online. You said, hashtag RBG was a fierce advocate for change and women's rights who worked to dismantle gender discrimination in the workplace during her 6 decades as a Supreme Court justice. For fighting for the rights of pregnant workers to actively working to close the gender wage gap, these are some of the ways her rulings have impacted American business. Thank you, Justice Ginsburg. So my question is, has Justice Ginsburg's advocacy for change and women's rights impacted you? And how has it impacted you, especially since you're in a male-dominated industry?
Well, yeah, I think not only me, but she's the original cracker of the glass ceiling, right? She actually blew right through it. And so I think that opened so many more doors for women. I think I've busted through a lot of glass ceilings. When I first started working at the bank in 1988, there were no women in leadership positions. And now I'm one of 5 women who report to the CEO. So almost 50% of the direct reports are women. 40% of our board are women. So I think we are continuing to make progress. But yeah, she was a pioneer in that regard, no doubt about it. And I think, you know, Jane Fraser, who's now taken over at Citibank, she's going to be the new CEO, is the first woman CEO of a large financial services institution, which is awesome. Financial services has lagged behind many of the other industries. And so that's great to see, but we're not going to stop. We're going to keep going and we're going to keep creating paths for other women and showing people and bringing them along with us. That's what we do.
Thank you so much. I mean, yeah, I think that we all, I don't even know why I asked that question. I mean, who doesn't look up to Justice Ginsburg? She was absolutely amazing. And yeah, just the amount of like lives that we've lost this year is really, so like 2020 has been such a hard year for everyone, but I think that one definitely impacted a lot of people. I was just wondering if you had any advice for other women who would want to be in executive positions as well.
Well, I think, you know, we've talked a lot about things that I would suggest you do, but Millie, even you said this, it's around networking, it's around building relationships, it's around taking chances on yourself. And these aren't really just particular to women, but generally for everyone. It's about being curious. It's about trying new things. But often I think women aren't as bold in doing this as men. One of the things I've seen, and there's lots of studies out there that support it, but men, let's say a job comes up, a man might be 20 or 30% qualified, but raises his hand right away. A woman might be 40, 50, 60% qualified, but will not raise her hand until she's 80% qualified. So you've got this whole gap of men continue to raise their hand and going in different places and women waiting to get what they think they need to get before doing that. So that's that taking a chance. Just if you're interested, raise your hand. What's the worst thing that can happen? No, no, you're not going to get the job. No, you're not qualified. So, you know, just try it. And if they say no, whoever it is, understand what you need to do to get a yes. And use that as an opportunity. So I just think it's also about pay. One of the things I've seen over my career, men are, and remember, I ran HR. So men are much quicker and more frequently asking for raises than women. So I do a lot of coaching with women in our industry and others. I have a social worker friend who calls me anytime she gets more responsibility. I'm like, okay, go ask for a raise. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about how to have that conversation. But that's just not something that has come so easily for women. So it's about, you know, taking those kind of chances, having the conversation and understanding if they say no, okay, well, then what do you need to learn from that? And then how can you be more successful in the ask the next time?
Once again, I think that's wonderful advice. And just going back to like one of the first statements that you had just made about raising your hand first. I mean, you don't know until you try. And I think right. that once again, I think everyone struggles with that, but like definitely, like you said, women and like females, we definitely think are more hesitant to like raise our hand and to put ourselves out there because we have like such high expectations for ourselves. Once again, I'm saying that relates all to all people, but just staying on the topic of like women. So yeah, thank you. Come to the part of our show where we wrap it all up. But we wanted to ask you, and we ask all of our guests to make their personal statement. So, Andrea, the amazing trailblazing woman that you are in your career, and also the wonderful wife and mother that you are with your family, we wanted to ask you, in 100 years from now, what is the statement that you want to have made to the world?
I would say, use your voice, get engaged, and find your passion. If you do those things, we will be a better world for it.
Thank you so much. That was so like concise, but like wrapped it all up, period. Okay. We love that.
How you know that?
Well, thank you all so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. I love the questions.
Now I want to leave our listeners with one final thought and call to action. We all have a choice to make a statement daily. What will be your next statement? Thank you, Andrea, for a great conversation, and thank you all for tuning in. See you December 3rd for our final episode of Personal Statement.